Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Susanna Constantine, and this is my Wardrobe Malfunction, the podcast for people who wear clothes and have something interesting to say about them. So pretty much everybody, really. If you're new to the party, we've dozens more episodes for you to devour with wonderful figures like Nicola Benedetti, Michael Simpkins, Gail Porter, and Dr. Range. But now, let's get on to today's special guest, the best-selling and award-winning author and screenwriter, William Boyd. He recently published his 16th novel, Trio, and I've been a huge admirer of his work for years, so I was thrilled and a little bit nervous to meet him. So let's grab the handles, open my wardrobe doors, and find out what's inside. So today I am absolutely astonished that my guest has agreed to do this. He is a literary hero of mine and probably one of this country's best-selling and best authors. It's William Boyd. Will Boyd, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Susanna. Very happy to be here on this wet morning.
I mean, you are amazing. You're a bit like the kind of Meryl Streep of the literary world, because you've had more awards handed out to you probably than any other author, haven't you?
Well, I don't know about that. I've certainly won a few prizes in my time, but it's been quite a long time. My first novel was published in 1981, shock horror, Good Man in Africa. That'll be 40 years next year.
Oh my goodness, is it really?
I know, it's terrifying. Yes, I've won a few prizes along the way, and it's nice to win a prize, but it's not why you write. You know, it's just part of the sideshow of the literary life. The main thing is the books coming out. That's the key thing. And I'm producing one new novel every 3 or every 2 years. I'm speeding up as I get older, but keeping the books in print all over the world. My books are all available in Germany, France, USA, Spain, Italy. That's the challenge now, as I'm entering the late to middle phase of my career, as I like to call it.
But do you feel, is it for you, because it didn't start out as a vocation, the arts, you loved art, but is it something that you wouldn't be able to stop now? It's like you've always got ideas coming to you. Are you on a road to continuing this for the rest of your life?
Totally and utterly. I'm super conscious of how lucky I am as well. One of my great literary heroes, Anton Chekhov, said, "All I want to be is a free artist." And to be a free artist, I think, is a wonderful thing. You can pay the rent and put food on the table, and carry on, working yourself alone with your brain and your writing implements, then it's a wonderful thing. And I never knew if I was going to be able to do it, but around about 1983, it became apparent that I could, because I'd written a movie as well as two books. And so since then, I've been a free artist. I write films, I write TV, I write plays now, and I write 16 novels. My 16th has just appeared, so I've never been busier, funnily enough, at the moment. And long form television is the new mother load, and
absolutely,
but it's as long as I can keep the show on the road, I'll be happy.
But do you think you can ever be a free artist if you have to pay the rent with the money you're making from writing or painting? Or
well, I think, yes, you have to be able to, it's a job, it's a career as well. So you have to have a certain income in order to, be able to indulge your artistry. And, luckily for me, I've been able to do that. But one of the reasons I started writing films and started writing television was precisely to give myself this kind of safety net, so that if it took me 5 years to write a novel, you know, I wouldn't be begging in the streets. So I've always had this parallel career of writing for film and writing for television. And I do a lot of journalism as well, which just sort of subsidizes my novel writing. You know.
Sorry.
Shut up!
Must be the postman.
Because it takes me so long to write a novel, you know, I need to, have some money coming in. But luckily for me, my books have always been published around the world. So you write a book and it gets published in, you know, 17 or 18 other countries. And I do very well in France. I do very well in Germany. So they're big territories for me, and that's what keeps the old cash flow flowing and allows me, you know, the freedom to take as long as I like to write the next novel.
Which country do you think are the biggest book readers? Is it Holland or?
Yes, I mean, Holland is very, very big. I mean, per capita, I mean, the Scandinavian countries are very big readers because they have such long winters, you know. So, but it's interesting. Somewhere like Spain, for example, where my books do very well and are all in print, but the print runs and the sales are quite modest compared to the UK or France or Germany. Germany is a massive territory, 80 million Germans and a big book culture. So it's very hard to say, but I think, you know, if I've got UK, France and Germany, you know, ticking over nicely, then I can sort of relax a bit.
Yeah. You know, to be a writer, and especially with you, you seem to be an acute observer of people. But despite that, I was surprised to see that you have a genuine interest in clothes. Where's that come from?
Well, I think it probably comes from my wife, Susan, who's a very stylish and fashionable person. And she did work for many years in the sort of glossy magazine world. She was the editor at large of Marie Claire magazine, and then the editor at large of Harper's Bazaar in the USA. So she has sort of 20 years of that kind of high-end fashion. And of course, I'm kind of magpie, picking up all sorts of things. But I think if you're a novelist, one of the things you must have, one of the three essential things you must have, is a love of observation. You must like watching the cinema of everyday life, the passing parade, and noting it in great detail. And so I think it's intrinsic to being a novelist that you notice what people are wearing, you notice how people speak, you notice how they, you know, get in and out of a car. That sort of, you're almost a bit like a spy, I think. I've made that comparison in the past, that you're looking at the world for clues, and of course clothes are amongst the biggest clues that anybody can give away about the person you are, about your ambitions for yourself or your pretensions or your inadequacies. You know, it's really, really fascinating. And when you're writing about the past, as I often do, the recent past, the clothes people wear are a fantastic indication of the time and their income bracket and their sort of social mobility, etc., etc. Mm. So, as a writer, clothes are a fantastically good tool for you to depict character.
Because that's your most recent novel, which has just come out, Trio. That's set in the 60s, late 60s in Brighton. I mean, for that, did you draw on memory, or did you have to do quite a lot of research into what people were wearing?
Well, I was 16 in 1968, so I have
old enough to know what people were wearing.
I think I bought my first pair of bell bottoms in 1968. Remember going to a discotheque in
London. Oh my God, that's showing your age. Yeah,
which I know exactly. But the DJ sat in a white E-Type Jaguar in the middle of the dance floor. So I have memories of the 60s, which are quite clear. But of course, I did masses of research, and you know, one of my characters is a young American actress, so she's super chic and super trendy. But another character is a 40-year-old woman novelist, and the other one is a 60-year-old man. So all three of them dress entirely differently, and in fact, the way they dress tells you a lot about them. Mm. So I did a lot of research, and I use photographs a lot when I write novels. Anyway, I have a magnifying glass and a book of photographs. It's amazing what you can spot in the background.
So I would imagine the 60-year-old in Trio is stuck in the 50s a little bit.
Yes, he's a war veteran. Of course, it's 68, not that long since the end of World War II. And so he's a very, very immaculately dressed, something of a dandy, but it's dark suit, white shirt and regimental tie. You know, he takes care over his appearance, but if you saw him in the 60s, you'd immediately say throwback. You might even say 1930s, even, because he dresses exactly like a man would dress in the 1930s and the 40s. And so the world that's changing around him, the world of the swinging 60s, the so-called swinging 60s, is something of a shock, you know. And he teams up with a young sort of private investigator called Ken Kincaid, who is super
great
cool.
Name.
super cool. In fact, the funny thing is, I'm not giving away too much. They're both gay, but Talbot, the producer, the 60-year-old producer, is hiding his gayness, whereas Ken, part of the 60s, is very relaxed about his gayness. Mm. So it's a very interesting double act for a certain part of the novel that the two of them have to go to Paris together to try and find somebody. So it's but again, their clothes really mark out their personalities.
All three characters, they're all kind of harboring secrets. And so is there any indication of those secrets and how they dress? Is there anything, are there any clues as to their dark side?
Probably only in Talbot, you know, because he's so proper. But his secret life, and you're right, absolutely right, it's about secret lives, this novel, and it's about how almost everybody has a secret life, but some people's secret lives are a bit more fraught and tense than others. And in the course of the novel, the secret lives of these three characters, this trio, come to overwhelm their public lives, the public face they present to the world. So it's quite interesting, because Elfriede is one of these people who's trying to hide behind her a kind of mask that she creates. She combs her hair forward to her eyebrows. She has great her hair is almost like a kind of helmet, and she wears very heavy specs. She has very heavy makeup, as if she's creating a kind of mask.
Armor.
Well, yes, and she is a raving alcoholic. That's her secret life, and. Talbot, as I said, is dressed like an immaculate 1930s gent, and Annie Viklund, the young American star, is very cool. But interestingly, she's dyed her hair, which I think is very interesting. She's dyed her hair. She's a blonde. She's Swedish by origin, but she's dyed her hair, and it's cut very short with a very short fringe. And she's sort of based on the actress Jean Seberg. I don't know if you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And Jean Seberg, in a way, popularized.
But she was blonde.
Yeah, but she popularized the short fringe. So I made Annie dark just to distinguish her slightly. But again, that dyed black hair means that she's not recognized in England, because her image, her public image, is of this blonde, you know, like Jean Seberg, but she's dyed her hair for the movie. So you're absolutely right. I mean, I hadn't thought about it, but in many ways, the physical appearance of the three at the center of the novel are very, very indicative of the kind of lives they want to lead, and in a way, a kind of barrier that they're setting up so that their secret lives can't be perceived.
With you, what do your clothes say about you, Will? So you seem to like quite a lot of navy.
Well, I originally had this plan. I'm interested in clothes, but I can't be bothered with the fuss of clothes. So quite early on in my life, I thought I'm only going to wear shades of blue. so I can stumble out of bed, grab a shirt, pair of trousers and a jacket, and they'll all match because they're all shades of blue. And that's my selection process over for the day. Of course, it's slightly evolved since then, but I think that people used to laugh at me because I was always wearing pale blue shirts and navy blue jackets. But it was partly just so I didn't have to kind of fret about whether, you know, this shirt matched that jumper or this pair of trousers went with these shoes, because I had got one sort of layer of tones in my cupboards and shelves, and everything matched effortlessly. I have moved into white and grey, you'll be glad to hear, but it's still pretty.
Do you want a medal? Wow, goodness
it's
me!
It's still pretty monochrome. And that's, yeah. But I think. So I don't think, I mean, this is the slightly vainglorious aspect. I don't think you could say I had a particular style. But in fact, if you look closely, everything has been very well chosen. And the only area of my wardrobe where I allow myself a bit of leeway is my shoes. So I will wear red shoes or white shoes or...
Oh, God forbid. What, red leather shoes or trainers?
Red leather shoes. I don't wear trainers. But
where do you find a pair of red leather shoes for a man?
Just bought a pair, actually. I think I bought them online, but there's a shop in the King's Road, which is a kind of bespoke cobblers, and they have the most amazing shoes in the window. I mean, some of them I wouldn't dare wear because they're far too over the top. But I did find a fantastic pair of red Chelsea boots in there, which when I go on stage to do talks, I wear, and I do get the odd comment. But that's the only area where I abandon my, you know, white, navy, grey, pale blue look.
But I would say, I mean, that is such a sort of contradiction. I'm wearing red Chelsea boots.
Yes.
Is a very bold move.
Yes.
I mean, I can't, so I wish I could see them. I mean, to be honest, will they sound absolutely hideous?
Well, they're slightly extreme, but because the rest of my outfit is so kind of monochrome, it's the one bit that sort of leaps out and says, oh, maybe he's more interesting than he looks, you know.
Yeah.
That's the theory. But often it just attracts hilarity, you know. That's the one area of my, this kind of sort of thought through wardrobe that I allow myself a little bit of a devil may care aspect, you know.
And you have very strong opinions about button-down shirts. What are they?
Yes. Well, I love button-down shirts. In fact, one of the very first things that I bought, I remember there was a shop in London when I came to London for the first time in the 1970s called Flip, PHLIP. And it was importing secondhand American clothes. So you could get college jackets and chinos and things like that, which you couldn't get in those days. And I remember buying these button-down shirts, which were old Brooks Brothers shirts, which they had relaundered. And I really liked them. And actually, again, this shows how thought through my wardrobe is. The cut of a Brooks Brothers shirt, which has been established for, you know, 150 years or something like that, is an American classic. And I found them incredibly comfortable to wear. And they're very, very good cotton. And so I went to New York for the first time in 1980, in fact. And I bought 10 Brooks Brothers shirts, all pale blue, with button downs. And I'm still wearing this 40 years later. They're very soft, but they're incredibly long lasting. And actually, over the years, when I went back to New York, because I went there a lot because Susan, my wife, was working there, I think I must have about 60 Brooks Brothers shirts. And I've actually written articles about them. But I have some white ones. I have some striped ones. I have a pink one. I think. But shock horror. But I think that I've always worn button-down shirts. I'm not wearing one at the moment, actually, funny enough. But 95% of my shirts are button-down because I don't wear a tie either.
Okay, what's your view on ties?
Well, I mean, I'm so glad that my job doesn't allow me to wear ties, because I don't know about other men, but when I put on a tie, I seem to cook up. I seem to get incredibly hot. It's the same with cufflinks. If my wrists and my neck are somehow, you know, shut down or shut it closed in by material, I just start to perspire and I feel incredibly hot. So I maybe wear a tie five times a year, you know, if I have to go somewhere where I need to put one on. But other, I have quite a few ties, I'm so pleased I don't have to wear them, you know, to go to work or go to the office or something like that. So, again, a tie is where I allow myself a little bit of freedom of expression. I have some quite lurid ties. so when I do have to put them on, it's like saying, oh, look, I'm not a habitual tie wearer.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
So in your, who would you say in your novels, or actually in fiction, is sort of one of the most stylish characters? Female characters.
Female characters, interesting. I'm trying to think.
I mean, it's a very broad, big question for a big subject. But
yeah, well, I wrote a novel called Sweet Caress, which is all told...
Like the photographer.
Yeah, all told from the point of view of this photographer called Amory Clay. And because she's a photographer, she's, again, a bit like a novelist. She's very sharp-eyed. And so I think Amory is actually very stylish in the way she dresses and the choices she makes. And she's also a war photographer. So she's in the course of her life, she goes to war zones, you know, World War II or the Vietnam War. She is probably the most fashion conscious of the women characters that I've created. I wrote a book called Brazzaville Beach, which is again told from the point of view of a woman called Hope Clearwater. But she's a scientist, she's a primatologist. And so she's in the jungles of Africa studying chimpanzees. And so she's basically wearing, you know, bush wear, as it were. Mm-hmm. And she's not that bothered about clothes, you know, even though she's an attractive person. But I do think, yes, I think Amory Clay is probably the most self-conscious about the clothes she wears. And she also notices what other people wear.
Being a photographer.
Yeah, being a photographer, you know.
It's so interesting, this whole side of writing and appearance of your characters. It's really illustrating how important it is, you know, talking to you with this, and how identity plays a huge part.
I think it's very true of all sort of, you know, Western developed nations, but it's particularly true of British life, I think, in the sense that it's very, you can read people quite easily in this country, maybe not so much today, but in the past you could read somebody about their background, their upbringing, their value system by what they wear.
Their shoes.
Yes.
I mean, your red shoes are a very diverting indication of who you are.
I tried to throw people off the scent, you know. but it's true. I mean, there's certain, you know, comes down to things like, you know, do you wear a signet ring? Do you have monogrammed shirts? What kind of tie do you choose? What's your hair like? You know, we, the British, are sending out signals, because we're such a class-dominated country, about the class we belong to, or what we think about class. You know, and so I think clothes are a very, very interesting route into you know, not getting to the bottom of somebody, but certainly opening a door on that person.
Yeah, and first impressions,
exactly,
obviously.
Exactly, yeah.
So when you were writing your James Bond novel, Solo, did you have restrictions as to how he would appear? He was 45 at the time, wasn't he? Or were you given, could he have turned up in a caftan?
Well, it's interesting. You would, somebody like me wouldn't take on the job if you had all these restrictions. So that's the Fleming family give the writers of these continuation novels, as they're called, absolute freedom, as long as they respect the tradition of the Bond genre, if you like. You couldn't kill him off or something like that. But it's very interesting because Fleming, Ian Fleming, who in creating James Bond, he isn't James Bond, but he gave James Bond all of his foibles and obsessions. And Fleming is a very interesting man. He was very interested in women's clothes, for example. And it's extraordinary to read the James Bond novels because you suddenly said Bond noticed that the silk was cut on the bias. You sort of think, hang on, you're a spy, mate. What are you doing? and things that Fleming disliked, for example, Fleming disliked women with nail varnish. And so he didn't like women to paint their nails for some odd reason. Mm. And so Bond doesn't like a woman to paint her nails. And Bond is, like Fleming, is very particular about what he wears. A knitted tie, not a sort of silk tie. Types of cotton. He's obsessed with types of sea island cotton. So Bond is a natty dresser, in fact, because Fleming was. And, the extraordinary thing, these books were largely written in the 1950s, but because Fleming was so fastidious, Bond is so fastidious, he cares about the type of marmalade he has at breakfast or the type of coffee he grinds to make his morning coffee. He can recognize perfumes, famous perfumes of the era, all stuff that is kind of unlikely for an agent in the field, but because they were Fleming's gifts to him,
Yeah, but yes and no. I mean, what a great asset to have as a spy.
Yeah,
it's to be able to notice these things.
And so when I wrote Solo, I being very aware of Fleming's Bond, because I reread all the novels again with a pen in hand, taking notes. Everything that might seem a bit odd in my novel is actually sourced in Fleming. And so
really,
when Bond meets he has an affair with an actress, in fact, who's a sort of star of Hammer horror films. But he notices everything about her, the way she cuts her hair, the perfume she's wearing. She's wearing a cat suit because it's 1969. Mm. So throwback male, which he has a lot of Fleming's values. There is something almost designery about his eye. Mm. He's very, 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 very acute about what...
An aesthetic.
Mm. Yeah, exactly.
So how much do you notice about and women's clothes? So, for example, my husband, God bless him, I will come into the room wearing a dress and he'll go, that's a nice skirt. Got no fucking idea. Okay. So how much do you... I mean, maybe you've kind of, through the research, you know more than most men do. But do you notice and understand what a woman might be wearing, like whether it's a box pleat or a sunray pleat or a hidden zip? Do you have that eye for detail as well?
To a degree. I mean, I think I do notice what people are wearing, and in the way that unreflectingly, just because of my sort of novelist's observational eye. Mm. And I take it in and I can describe it, maybe not as minutely as you've just done, but I could certainly say that Gypsy Rose Lee top doesn't go very well with the
gingham. What is a Gypsy Rose Lee top?
Well, that sort of frilly, scoop neck, frilly, okay. Big balloony sleeves, that sort of thing.
She wouldn't be wearing anything, Gypsy Rose, because she was a bloody stripper.
Yes, I probably should probably say a different type of. But I notice them. I can't perhaps give the precise name. unlike James Bond, you know, but I'm very aware of clothes, you know, even what kids are wearing, and you know, what football players are wearing, and the people I see in the street, you know, as I walk down the King's Road, you're unconsciously, your eye is just roving about, looking at things and filing them away, you know.
Have you ever had awkward, you know, been given sort of, has anyone, because if you're kind of like peering at everybody walking past, has anybody got a bit alarmed by that?
Not really. I'm very careful not to stare, you know. But I'm also listening, you know. I'm also listening to what people say if I'm on the tube or over at a bus stop or something. And I always carry a notebook with me, and I jot down conversations or I jot down observations, and they often find their way into a novel. And so I think it's part of that relentless observational, you know, ears and eyes and nose are open, as it were, and you're so the smells of London are as apparent to you as the sights of London, and it's just part of that. I once had this I said that a novelist is like a blue whale, you know, just your mouth's agape and you're sucking up sucking up the plankton of everyday life to nourish you, you know. And so that's what I wander up to take my jacket into the dry cleaners, there's a whole parade going on that I'm noticing, you know. And I think it's a fundamental part of being a novelist. I think that you're constantly looking and listening and paying attention. You know, it's just part of comes with the territory.
Talking about the dry cleaners, this is amazing. Well, now you're on Instagram, Will. You lost your gramming virginity.
Yes,
but there's an amazing couple, and they own a dry cleaning service and a laundry service. And so many of the clothes get left behind, and they wear them and they put them together in these most extraordinary items. And they've become like this sort of style iconic influencers. And they're both about in their 80s. But that is such a good premise for something. I don't know what, a novel or something.
Yeah,
but they're fantastic. They're fantastic. But so when you write, Will, do you get dressed, or are you a bit lazy sartorially when you sit down to write?
Pretty. I am quite lazy, but because I wear essentially the same things all the time, it's not I don't have this problem of thinking, what will I look like if I have to open the door to the postman, you know. I'm usually in shirt sleeves and chinos, and I've got these red moccasins I'm wearing today, actually. I don't shave every day, so I sometimes look a bit scruffy, but I'm presentable. You know, I'm not sitting there in my dressing gown and my pajamas. You know, it's I'm fully dressed, and I can answer the door without blushing. You know, so
yeah, and I imagine, like, you know, your desk is your office, so you've got dressed for work.
Yes, exactly. And it's just part of the start of the day. You know, I've never been one for lounging around in a dressing gown half the day. I've always, you know, woken up, got dressed, and, you know, had breakfast kind of thing. So it's, you know, and I can pop out without thinking I better change my trousers or something like that. So I'm fully functioning.
Okay, I'm glad to hear that.
Yes,
and
yes.
So, pre and post COVID, you know, you travel the world to promote your books. And do you have anything that you always take with you, like some form of comfort blanket?
Not really. I mean, I always have my notebook with me. In fact, I have two notebooks on the go at any time, and always have something to read. That's my key thing. But I, you know, if I have a 5-hour delay at an airport, it's not a problem for me, because I'll probably get the idea for two short stories just wandering around looking at people. But I'm always jotting things down. And I think that, you know, you're stuck in a hotel room or you're waiting for, a program to start, and you can flick through your notebook and see what your thinking has been over the last few weeks. So that's the thing I carry with me most, I think. And I don't have any, you know, I never, when I do long haul, I never change into these pajamas that they offer you, or use the duvets. I lie there in my clothes. So,
well, you clearly travel first class or business class, because you don't get that in a common economy. Well,
exactly. No, well, that's one of the perks. One of the perks of having other people pay for your airfares. You know, I've been traveling all my life because I was born in Africa and I grew up there. And so from my very earliest memories are of getting on a plane, you know, rackety old propeller planes and flying back to Britain. So I've always traveled. I like flying. I'm actually quite glad not to be flying this year, because last year, Susan and I went on 42 flights. Too much, you know. You get back home and you're packing to leave again. So actually, in a funny sort of way, this COVID slowdown has been a benefit in a way, that we've actually stayed put, or had to stay put. And of course, the wonders of Zoom. Just this last week, I was at a literary festival in Milan, one in Hong Kong, and one in Melbourne, Australia. I mean, how bizarre is that?
You know,
exactly. So will we ever leave our homes again?
This is the question.
Yeah, exactly.
Will you have an opportunity for a wardrobe malfunction then? And have you had a wardrobe malfunction where an item of clothing has let you down?
I'm trying to think about that. Yes, I think on occasions I have been dressed by other people for shoots, you know, particularly in France, because I turn up to have my photograph taken to present my book, and they look at me in sort of appalled silence, and they've got a rack of clothes, and I have been dressed for, you know, I suppose fashion shoots, and they've been wardrobe malfunctions in my opinion. You know, like I once had to wear a white suit, and there's another time I had to pose for a very big French magazine called Gala, where they created
huge
a kind of,
magazine.
Yeah, yes, where they created a kind of fake picnic for me with a I think a Burberry rug on the lawn, and me dressed in a trench coat and you know, shirt and tie, something like that. It just looked, was so not me. It was a
so
joke.
Not you,
and
I can imagine.
But I wouldn't do it now, but I was too young and embarrassed to say, you know, forget it, I'm not doing this. But those are the times when I've had, in my opinion, serious wardrobe malfunctions. But maybe other people have thought I've never looked better, you know. So, my clothes strategy is there precisely to prevent a wardrobe malfunction, and it's pretty efficient in that regard. But when other people take over, it can go disastrously wrong.
It goes horribly wrong. And then what about your birthday suit? Something that your go-to outfit, you probably don't have one, that you would wear on high days and holidays that makes you feel joyous, apart from your navy shirt and your red shoes.
Well, it's quite funny. This is another little sign of me breaking out of my navy blue, pale blue world. But my books have started to do very well in Germany. And I've been to Germany a lot promoting the books, and I've come to like very much this German style called Tracht, and Tracht is sort of traditional clothing. So I have
not Lederhosen.
No, not Lederhosen, but you know, these little jackets with buttons and like a sort of little belt at the back, like a Norfolk jacket. And I've got...
With the accordion. Then they wear them when they're playing, and their little tricorn hat.
I don't have a hat, but I do have these two jackets, Tracht jackets, which I really love. One is black. One is black with silver buttons that I wear at night. And the other one is cotton, and and I actually have been complimented on them. I was crossing Albert Bridge, and this woman said to me as she passed, "I do like to see a bit of crap." So that's my kind of. I've been wearing it a lot recently, actually. So probably it's my favourite jacket. So
I do know exactly the.
Bavarian Austrian men's jackets. You know, that's my Achilles heel.
Okay. I'm so happy for you, Will.
Thank you, sir. I can tell, I can hear the sympathy in your voice.
Oh, my goodness, you are amazing. Well, listen, I'm going to love you and leave you and let you get on with your day. But what joy to talk to the great Will Boyd about everything other than books and writing. And I'm so grateful that you agreed to be a guest on my wardrobe malfunction.
It's been a real pleasure, Susanna. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks so much to Will. I loved meeting him over Zoom, of course. Remember, his new novel, Trio, is out now and would make a perfect Christmas gift, in my humble opinion. Right, I'm nearly off, but I can't disappear without mentioning our pyjama party, the place where you tell me all about your own clothing calamities. It's on our website at mywardmail.com, and you can email any stories to help@mywardmail.com. You can also find and follow us on the usual socials at mywardmail, and make our Christmas come early by giving us a 5-star rating and review. Finally, thanks to our heavyweight house band Duo. Find and buy their new album at duoguitarmusic.com or at Duo Guitar Music on their socials. Thanks again to Will, and of course, thanks to you for listening. And also thanks to Mr. Chow, our budgie, who's twittering in the background. Anyway, let's catch up soon, and until then, my wardrobe is officially closed.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.